From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Once famous as an exotic Buddhist land, Burma is now famous for its repression and human rights abuses, and for keeping Nobel Peace Prize winner Aung San Suu Kyi under house arrest. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Thant Minh U. His new book about Burma is part history, part memoir. His grandfather, U Thant, was the Secretary General of the UN in the 60s. Also, writer Emily Rapp tells us what it was like to be a poster child, literally. She was born with a birth defect that slowed the growth of her bones. She's written a new memoir called Poster Child. And our critic at large, John Powers, considers why we love Alec Baldwin. Last night, Baldwin won a Golden Globe for his role on the NBC comedy 30 Rock. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Burma was once known as an exotic Buddhist land with few of the worries of the 20th century. But it's now a failed state, famous for nightmarish 21st century ills. It has the longest-running civil war in the world, 60 years. The country is now best known to Americans as the home of the 1991 Nobel Peace Prize winner Aung San Suu Kyi, who has been kept under house arrest. These are observations from the new book, The River of Lost Footsteps, Histories of Burma, by my guest, Thant Minh U. His parents are from Burma, and he spent several years of his childhood there. His grandfather, U Thant, was the Secretary General of the UN from 1961 to 71. And as we'll hear in a minute, during U Thant's funeral in Burma, his coffin became the center of a political fight between the government and rebelling students. Thant Minh U has followed in his grandfather's footsteps and worked with the UN in several positions, including head of policy planning in the Department of Political Affairs, and he served on UN peacekeeping operations in Cambodia and Bosnia. Thant Minh U, welcome to Fresh Air. Before we talk about your book and your life, I just want to ask you a very basic question, and that is, you're going to use the word Burma in our conversation, as you do in your book. Why do you choose to use Burma instead of the name the country was officially changed to, which is Myanmar?
Some people prefer Burma for political reasons, and they shy away from using Myanmar because it's the name that was given to the country by the current military government. But for me, it's more out of habit. It's slightly for aesthetic reasons. I think Burma sounds nicer in English. And also because Myanmar is actually an adjective in Burmese. It means Burmese rather than Burma. So as a Burmese speaker, it sounds to me sometimes slightly strange to refer to the country as Myanmar rather than Burma.
Well, your parents are both from Burma, but you grew up in New York, and you went to Burma for the first time when you were 8. And this was for the funeral of your grandfather, U Thant, who had recently served as Secretary General of the UN. And shortly after he stepped down from that position, he died. So you and your parents went to Burma for his funeral, and his funeral became the center point of this huge violent confrontation. First of all, protesting students protesting the military government, stopped the hearse and seized the coffin. Why did they do that?
It was a way for them both, I think, to show respect for my grandfather, who had been an important part of the last democratic government in Burma in the 1950s. It was also at a time of rising inflation and, I think, rising anti-government feeling, and it was a way of protesting the military government at the time. It wasn't something that my family had expected. I think we had thought that there might be problems, but nothing like what had actually happened. I think the student leaders were well-intentioned. I think they had wanted very much to have a fitting public burial and ceremony for my grandfather, but it turned after just a few days or a week or so into something much more violent.
What year was this?
This was at the end of 1974. He died in November of 74, and we left New York with his body to go to Burma a few days afterwards.
So the students basically seized the coffin and took off with it. What did they do with it?
The government had wanted, the dictator at the time, General Ne Win, had wanted as quiet a burial as possible. And they wanted my grandfather to be buried at a very small private cemetery on the outskirts of Rangoon. And this was seen as unacceptable by the student leaders that were emerging at that time. And they took the coffin with the body, and they had wanted to bury him at the site of the old student union at Rangoon University, which is where they were studying. And this was a place that had great historical value to Burmese nationalism. It was the place where Burmese nationalists had gathered and had made speeches and had organized in the 1930s and 1940s, and it had been blown up by the Burmese military government in 1962. So they had wanted to bury him and to create a mausoleum for him at that site. But quickly, within a day or two, it had turned from this student protest of several hundred, perhaps a couple of thousand students, into a much bigger anti-government protest that had attracted probably thousands, if not tens of thousands, of other people as well. And it quickly become probably the biggest challenge to the military government since they had taken over in 62, 12 years before.
Well, and then your grandfather's coffin became like a football. The military took it back. And then the students took it back again.
Well, the military, there had been negotiations that my family, my father, And my uncles, my great uncles, had tried to broker between the student leaders and the military government. And the outlines of what they were discussing was some way where my grandfather would be buried in a public mausoleum, that there would be some sort of public ceremony, and there would be amnesty for the student leaders who had started all this. But those talks then broke down after a few days, and the government then lost patience and forcefully took the body back in a pre-dawn raid on the university that left many students dead. We don't know exactly how many. And that in turn touched off fairly widespread rioting and violence throughout the capital and the imposition of martial law.
So where was your grandfather finally buried?
He was finally buried at the foot of the Shwedagon Pagoda, which is the most holy site in Burmese Buddhism. And this was the place that had been discussed between the students and the government and my family during those few days of very tense negotiations. So I remember we were staying at a hotel on the outskirts of Rangoon, and we were phoned, or my parents were phoned, very early in the morning, and my father had to go out. The government had told him that they had seized the coffin back. They showed him and my great uncles my grandfather's body so that they could be witness to the fact that he was now being reburied at this new site. But we only learned later in the day of the violence that had taken place at the university just that morning, when dozens of students had tried to protect the coffin to the very end and were probably killed, gunned down by the government forces who took over the campus at the time.
Well, after your grandfather's funeral, your family was told to leave the country. But you and your parents moved back to Burma when you were how old?
Well, we moved to Bangkok when I was 12 years old. And I went to school in Thailand, but we spent most of our summers, or many of our summers and other holidays, in Rangoon. So I spent a lot of my time between 12 and 17 living in Thailand, but traveling very often to Burma and spending summers there.
In 1988, you went to live in a Burmese rebel base camp. What was the camp and what were you doing there?
In July of 1988, there had already been some sporadic anti-government demonstrations, mainly in Rangoon, and these were starting to grow in both size and intensity. But it was only in the beginning of August 1988 that they became something like a real challenge to the military dictatorship. And the demonstrations grew into tens of thousands of people taking to the streets. And the military dictator at the time, General Ne Win, in an unprecedented speech to his own political party, said that Burma should perhaps consider a return to a multi-party, meaning a more democratic form of government. And this only energized the demonstrations, and soon hundreds of thousands of people were taking to the streets. I was at the time working as an intern with the UN in Geneva, and I, like everyone else of my generation, I was 22 then, was very excited by the prospects of some sort of revolution or revolutionary change in the country that would make the country democratic and set it on a much better path to the future. But by September, the middle of September, these demonstrations were very brutally suppressed by the Burmese army, and at least hundreds of people were killed in Rangoon as a consequence. And thousands of Burmese students who had been leading many of those demonstrations left Rangoon and fled to the Burmese-Thai border, which is a huge 1,000-mile-long border, into areas that were run by ethnic rebels who had been fighting themselves for autonomy from the Burmese government for decades. And all of a sudden, you had thousands of these students living amongst thousands of ethnic guerrillas. They weren't refugees. They weren't necessarily fleeing because they were afraid of what was going to happen next in Rangoon. There was an element of that. But they were hoping that they could regroup, that they could get arms and support, perhaps from the United States or from others. Perhaps they could get training from some of these ethnic rebels, and then they would go back and fight the Burmese government, who had just killed dozens of or hundreds of their friends and colleagues. And I couldn't get back to Burma in time for the demonstrations in August. I was trapped in Bangkok because the airport was shut down at the very beginning of September. But when the students, who were exactly my age, came out to the border and were in the string of these jungle camps for weeks, I immediately went there and met many of them. I stayed there for several months, on and off, over late 1988 and 89. And many of them were interested again in a sort of violent overthrow of the government and training to be soldiers to overthrow the government. I was there because I think I shared with them their analysis of what had happened. I shared with them a desire to see political change. But in the end, I didn't share with them their sense that a violent revolution starting with an insurgency on the border was the answer.
So I eventually left. Why didn't you think a violent revolution was the answer?
Because you had an army in Burma that was, even at that time, almost 200,000 men who were very much in control of the situation. I didn't think that anything other than a major power, the United States or some other country, actually in a Cold War style building up a huge army on the border would be able to topple the government. And even in 1988, it would have been impossible, I think, to get the United States or any other country, any other major country, to fund and arm the kind of insurgency that it would take to topple a 200,000-man army, which had been fighting. It was a very tough army that had been fighting for decades already. And second, even if it was possible to challenge the army by building up another army of 100 or 200,000 people, it would have plunged Burma into a very long civil war. I thought there would be other and better ways of trying to change things than that.
My guest is Thant Minh U. His new book is called The River of Lost Footsteps, Histories of Burma. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Thant Minh U. His new book about Burma is part history, part memoir. It's called The River of Lost Footsteps. You know, in 1988, the period that we're talking about right now, the dictator in Burma, Ne Win, he believed in astrology, and apparently some of his rulings were based on these, like, mystical visions that he'd have, like deciding to abolish the currency and replace it with a new one in which all the notes were divisible by nine, and decreeing that the Burmese had to switch overnight to driving on the right side instead of the left side. Was, like, what impact did it have on Burmese culture to have, you know, a dictator who also thought he was having visions and would make these, you know, kind of bizarre changes based on that?
Well, General Ne Win, by the later part of his rule, by the late 1970s and 1980s, had become increasingly arbitrary, had become strange in terms of the policy decisions that he had made, like the ones that you had just mentioned. But he is, in general, a very enigmatic figure. I mean, I think he changed a lot also throughout his life. In the late 1940s and 50s, when he was head of the army, he was a very tough professional soldier, and he led the Burmese army at a time of civil war against mainly communist rebels throughout the country, as well as ethnic rebels. And when he took over in 1962, he instituted two sets of policies that have proven to be disastrous. One, he overthrew the democratic government and imposed a lasting military dictatorship. But second, he chose to nationalize all businesses, kick out all aid programs, and essentially isolate the country almost completely from the outside world in terms of trade, investment, tourism, and everything else. And in a way, some of these more arbitrary decisions later on about the currency, his dependence on astrologers from a lot of his decisions, were not as important as these really basic policy decisions that he made at the very beginning. He also expelled hundreds of thousands of ethnic Indians from the country in a very similar way to Idi Amin in Uganda not long afterwards. And that was also disastrous because the Indians in the country had been a big part of the business class in the country as well.
The protests of 1988 that we've been talking about is the time when Aung San Suu Kyi makes her first public address. And she, in 1991, won the Nobel Peace Prize. She was placed under house arrest before that. Why was she placed under house arrest?
She had emerged by that time as clearly the leading spokesman for the pro-democracy opposition in the country. she had always, I think, had a sense of responsibility towards the country, even though she had lived outside since she was very young in India and then in the UK and then in Bhutan for a short time. She was accidentally in Burma at the time of the 1988 uprisings, the time when I was in Geneva and then trying to get back into the country, because her mother was very ill and she had gone back to look after her. And during the demonstrations, a lot of the students, because they themselves had no clear leadership, many of them were carrying portraits of her father, General Aung San, who was a great Burmese nationalist leader in the 1940s. And they had tried to, they had encouraged her, as well as many other slightly older people, to join the movement and to help lead them, having taken things that far. And she gave a speech at the near the Shwe Dagon Pagoda during these demonstrations, and it attracted an enormous crowd, and she quickly emerged as a very popular figure. And after the government cracked down and ended the demonstrations in September of 1988, they did allow her and many others to form political parties. And her political party, the National League for Democracy, quickly became the most popular political party in the country. And her criticisms, not just of the military government, but of General Ne Win in particular, became that much more vocal. And she was put under house arrest, I think it was in June or July of the following year, 1989. But only after 9 months of campaigning, traveling around the country, setting up this party. And the government continued to allow her political party to campaign up to a point, though there was a lot of harassment, a lot of intimidation. And they held what were more or less free and fair elections in May of 1990. And I think to the surprise of many in the military, despite the fact that she was under house arrest, despite the harassment and intimidation that had taken place, the National League for Democracy won slightly over 60% of the vote and over 80% of the seats in this new assembly.
What's her status now in Burma? Is she still officially under house arrest?
She's under house arrest. She's been under house arrest on and off since 1989. There have been periods in which the government has freed her, allowed her to travel the country, allowed her to meet and organize her political party. And there have even been times when the government has entered into negotiations with her to try to find a political settlement. But then there have been many other times in which she's been under house arrest. She's now under house arrest and virtually cut off in terms of any sort of contacts with the outside world. There have been other times when she's been under house arrest, but able to meet with family and to take visitors. But that's not the case right now.
Now, in your book, you say that you think that because she's so well known, it's kind of reduced the conflict in Burma to the good guys represented by her and the bad guys represented by the military dictatorship. What's simplistic about that?
There's a myth of Burma. And the myth of Burma is that everything in Burma is okay except for the military government at the top. And that if in some way you could peel off this layer at the top of army generals, then in general, in other ways you have a nice Buddhist society of that's otherwise at peace and that would be able immediately to govern themselves through democratic institutions. And that's completely wrong. Burma since 1948, as I mentioned, has been at war. Burma is one of the most impoverished countries in the world. Burma, because of the military dictatorship over the last 40 years, has seen a complete withering away of all other state institutions. It's not like Pakistan or some other countries where you have a military government at the top, but then you have a civil service, a judiciary, other institutions. There's nothing to peel away. That the military is the state. So you have to transform that state. And I think part of that transformation of the state has to be through a lessening of Burma's isolation and addressing the central problem of a resolution of the armed conflict. I think the wrong paradigm in Burma is to think of it like to think of it as Czechoslovakia 15-20 years ago, where people take to the streets, there's some sort of uprising, the government gives away, and then you have a new democratic government. In Burma, it's that transition will be much more complex. So I think we need to take a much more complex picture of what's possible in the country right now.
You know, it sounds in some ways like there's a lot of pathology in Burma in terms of the leadership and the wars there and what has gone wrong. And it must be so much harder to fix a country you know, or to create a democracy in a country in which there has been so much pathology.
Absolutely. And I think it's two things which I try to point out in my book. One is a thing that happened very long ago in 1885, when the British first took over the country and annexed it to the Indian Empire, abolished the monarchy, abolished not just the system of government that had been in place for 1,000 years in many ways, but a whole court culture and system of doing things was sort of wiped away almost overnight. And so Burma completely lost its grounding in what had been a very long period of political and economic and social development within a certain framework for a very long time. That's the first. And the second is, you know, the decisions that the army took when it took power in 1962 in isolating the country. And it's very hard to understand from a place like New York or place outside, many places outside of Burma, of how damaging that isolation from the rest of the world has been in terms of the kinds of mentalities that have grown up, and the ways in which people have been completely cut off from so many intellectual currents and ideas from the outside, as well as just the poverty the economic poverty that has caused. So I think we need to think not in terms of a magic bullet or a quick fix or a grand strategy towards democracy in Burma. I think we have to have a very realistic appraisal of the situation in the country today and look at some initial first steps, both in terms of human rights and political change, but also in terms of economic development and humanitarian assistance, and in terms of ending the civil war, which has been, I think, the main plague on the country since 1948.
Well, Thant Minh U, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thant Minh U is the author of the new book, The River of Lost Footsteps, Histories of Burma. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of The Skin Type Solution, A Revolutionary Guide to Your Best Skin Ever, by Dr. Leslie Bauman. From the Cato Charitable Foundation, advancing environmental values and saluting all those who work to sustain our world. And from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, writer Emily Rapp tells us what it was like to be a poster child. She was born with a rare bone disorder. Now she's written a memoir called Poster Child. And what's so great about Alec Baldwin? Our critic at large, John Powers, tells us why he's happy Baldwin won the Golden Globe last night. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Emily Rapp was kind of famous in her Wyoming town when she was a child. At age 6, in 1980, she was chosen as a March of Dimes poster child. The problem that put her on the poster was a rare bone and tissue disorder that made her left leg misshapen and shorter than the right. At age 4, her left foot was amputated. Subsequent surgeries shortened her leg, which was eventually replaced with a prosthetic. Rapp went on to become a Fulbright Scholar and the Philip Roth Writer in Residence at Bucknell University. She's now a professor at Antioch University. She's written a new memoir called Poster Child. Let's start with a reading about her memories of the hospital when she had her foot amputated.
On May 26, 1978, A few months before my fourth birthday, I had the repeat osteotomy, a surgical incision into the bone to control a deformity, and my left foot was amputated to ensure a chance for a better fitting and more aesthetic prosthesis in the future. The nurses sang a song from the musical Annie as the anesthesiologist fitted the clear plastic mask over my face in the operating room, and I began to count backward slowly from 10. I regained consciousness in the recovery room with my head over a plastic bowl, vomiting. Recovery is a misnomer for this room, as little recovery happens here. What happens instead is discovery. What's been taken? What's been fixed? What's in a cast? Where does it hurt? I looked down at my body. My left leg looked like a rounded, bat-like object covered in plaster. The foot was gone. I looked around. Maybe it was nearby. Maybe in the next bed. No. When I turned my head, the world spun a bit. When objects were clear again, I saw, on either side of me, beds with side rails holding sleeping kids wearing casts that were slightly different from mine. When I tried to sit up, I realized I could not bend at the waist. I put my hands on my stomach, plaster there, too. I tried to shift my weight but could not. I could not bring my legs together. I could hardly move. Now I was angry as well as confused. "What's this?" I asked, batting at one of the nurse's arms as she helped lift me onto a rolling stretcher. "That's your cast, honey. You're going to get all better now." I knew she was lying. I was trapped again inside those walls of thick plaster. As the nurses wheeled me from recovery back to my room and my waiting parents, I kept screaming, "Let me out of this brick house."
And that's Emily Rapp reading from her new memoir, Poster Child. Emily, did you know before that surgery that your foot was going to be amputated?
My parents had talked to me somewhat about the fact that I was going to have an operation and it was going to change my body, but they spoke of it more in terms of what I was going to get, and that was going to be a prosthesis. And up until that time, I had been wearing a metal brace with a kind of foot bolster on the end to make up for the shortened leg, and it wasn't that functional. And so it was sort of pitched to me as an exciting thing, like, now you're going to get a leg and you're going to be able to move and run and all these great things. So they tried to be really positive about it. And they were also, I also was given a doll that had one leg. And I totally didn't understand what that doll was about, but people tried to sort of use visual aids with me to help me understand what was about to happen.
What was the problem that you were born with that required these surgeries and the amputation?
I was born with a congenital defect called proximal focal femoral deficiency, which is a long way of saying that one leg was shorter than the other. And so at that time, the way to remedy that situation was to amputate the foot and make a weight-bearing stump so that I could wear a prosthesis and therefore have sort of an artificial symmetry in my body.
And the size of the prosthesis, the length of the prosthesis could change as you grew.
Exactly, exactly.
What are some of the other surgeries you had to have as a child?
I had the amputation, and then I had a fusion of my knee, of the original knee, so that it wouldn't sort of break when I was walking, because I kept falling over, and my doctor referred to this knee as my football knee. I just, you know, it would sort of bend inside the prosthesis. And if you can imagine, that creates a really unstable sort of basis to walk on. So they fused it so that I would have like a stiff lever to move the prosthesis with. And I had several hip surgeries and then the osteotomy, which I mentioned, which was a controlled fracture. It's a way of sort of controlling the deformity. And a lot of these operations I had twice, which is why I ended up having so many, because they either didn't take the first time or, you know, I fell off a bench at school and broke something else. So it was more than it needed to be, in essence.
God, it sounds like torture.
Actually, you know, being in the hospital as a child, especially very sort of attention-seeking, vain little girl, was sort of fun. I mean, people paid a lot of attention to you, and you got presents, and your brother couldn't tease you, and you got to eat whatever you wanted. So it sounds a little bit silly, but I actually enjoyed being in the hospital a lot of times.
Now, in 1980, you became a poster child for the March of Dimes.
Yes.
For the Medicine Bow chapter of Albany County, Wyoming.
Wyoming.
Would you describe, I mean, you were literally on a poster. would you describe the poster, what your picture was like, what the caption said?
The poster is very 1980, so it's not a gorgeous looking poster. And it just says on the top, prevent birth defects. And then it says March of Dimes, 1981 Mother's March. And then there's a picture of me with like a few missing teeth in the front, wearing pigtails and a velour blue sort of jumpsuit. And that's it. And then it just has my name and the chapter name.
So how was the poster used and where did you run into it?
Well, it was actually all over the walls of my school. So I ran into it every time I was, you know, going to the bathroom or walk into choir or walk into gym class. And it was in community buildings, in stores, in the church. It was everywhere in this, you know, small town where I lived. So I ran into it quite a bit.
How did it affect you and your body image to have all these pictures of you whose job was to call attention to what set you apart physically from other people?
Mm. At the time, I know I didn't care. At the time, I was just excited to have attention. I think most kids, that I mean, I know some other poster children, and we talk about this. It's like you feel so special. You feel so singled out. And you don't really care what it's for because at that point, it doesn't really matter that your body is different. I mean, you're a child and your body is what it is. And interestingly enough, I never felt disabled as a child, actually, which seems completely silly when you read the book and read about all of these surgeries. But I was just, the leg was just something I had to sort of put on in order to catapult myself into the world, like the hyperactive kid that I was. I do think that being the poster child turned me into a kind of a brat. And in fact, my mom sometimes refers to this book as poster brat instead of poster child, because she said that after that, I was sort of even more of a precocious nightmare than before. So,
you know, some of the posters for people with, you know, birth defects or, mm-hmm. you know, other health problems, some of those posters, the purpose of them seems to be so that people who don't have the problem depicted in the poster can look mm-hmm. at it and say, there, but for the grace of God,
yeah.
go I. And you feel so grateful that that's not you or that's not like your child. And you're so relieved that you don't yeah. have this like defect that you give money as in mm-hmm. a way almost to like ward off. You know yeah. what I mean? To like you're grateful you don't have it and you're almost like superstitious. Did you feel that when you saw yourself on the post? Did you ever feel like people were going to look at you and say, oh, thank God that's not my daughter?
You know? No. Now, of course, I absolutely realize that. And, you know, it's interesting that you use that phrase there, but for the grace of God, go I. Because, you know, that's used with all kinds of people in this culture. When people see someone who's homeless or they find out that somebody lost a loved one, they say, oh, that just puts it into perspective. And, you know, it's not very comfortable to be on the other end of that and be sort of the reflection of somebody's worst nightmare, you know?
Right.
I mean, to be someone's mirror, it's really uncomfortable. And so, of course, later looking back at that, I'm like, oh, you know, and I've talked to other poster children and we're just like, what were our parents thinking? But they were probably thinking that maybe it would help us accept our disabilities in a different way. I mean, my parents had no real way or framework that they had never even thought they would have a child with this kind of problem. And it took them so much by surprise. So I don't fault them for making me the poster child by any means.
My guest is Emily Rapp. Her new memoir is called Poster Child. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Emily Rapp, has written a new memoir called Poster Child. She was a March of Dimes poster child when she was 6. She had a congenital bone disorder that required her foot, then her leg, to be amputated. Now, in your memoir, Poster Child, you write a little bit about the difficulties of going through puberty, a period when appearance becomes really important.
Mm-hmm.
So did your artificial leg, your prosthetic leg, present new problems to you when you started to go through puberty and then when you started to date?
It did create problems. I think I just realized suddenly that it was no longer this fun toy. It was no longer a way of garnering special attention. It was like a liability in the world of dating and being attractive. And that's when I began to feel really isolated. I felt isolated because I didn't know any other people that were with disabilities that were girls and that were my age. I only knew Vietnam veterans. Those were the guys with artificial legs that I knew. Those were my people. And so they didn't really have much to offer me about going through puberty as a girl in the 1980s. So I was isolated, and I started to become really angry because I didn't know how to deal with it.
Oh, and it sounds like you became really obsessive about your hair and about makeup.
Oh,
and you became anorexic for a while, too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, this is a sort of not common, but unfortunately more common than we think. If you can't sort of meet an impossible standard in society in one way, then maybe you can meet it in another. And so for me, it was, well, if I can't have two legs, well, I'm going to be the skinniest person in my class, which at the time meant the most attractive. I mean, we all know the obsession with thinness is, you know, raging out of control in this country. And at that time, certainly it was, being skinny was in. So I thought, well, that's what I'll do. I'll be the skinniest person, and no one will be able to be as skinny as me. And maybe that will somehow, you know, bring up my rank in the attractive category and sort of overcompensate for this missing leg. It's terrible logic, but when you're going through it, it feels like it makes perfect sense.
And were you rewarded in some way for being that thin?
Yes, I was. In terms of attention, I mean, I've never, ever gotten so many compliments about my appearance as I did when I weighed about 95 pounds in high school. Because that was, you know, it was good to be thin. And that's sort of shocking to me. When I look at those pictures, I think, oh, I look like I need to eat like an enormous sandwich. But at the time, people were like, oh, you know, you look so great. You have such great cheekbone structure. And, you know, and of course, I ate those compliments up. And, you know, but it wasn't something I could maintain. I mean, it would be impossible to maintain any kind of life of the mind on 800 calories a day. So when I got to college, that kind of obsession fell away.
You know, you write, to remove the leg in front of a man was unthinkable. Mm. The very thought of it sickened me. I had no sense of myself as a desirable sexual woman, as an amputee.
Mm.
And I think that's really easy to comprehend how you'd feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what
mm-hmm.
I mean? Because we're,
of
like,
course.
Most people are so self-conscious to begin with.
Of course.
Then you add something like that, and that's even more self-conscious. But was that something you were able to just kind of, like, put behind you, you know, that feeling? Were you able to get past that?
I was, yes. And I think you bring up an important point, because I think one of the great disservices that cultural stereotypes do to people with disabilities, they make us asexual. They sort of rob us of any sexual desire. And you can see this in depictions of people with disabilities in movies, with some exceptions, in literature, and in society. And I think, you know, we are sexual people. To say that we're not is to make us somehow subhuman. And so in the process of claiming my sexuality, I had to sort of claim my body. And it, you know, it's of course not something that, you know, every day isn't a great day. It's a process. And sometimes I still struggle with things like that. But yes, I was able to put it behind me, but it wasn't easy.
What is the difference between the prosthetic you have now and what you had when you were a child and first had your foot amputated?
Oh, well, night and day difference. The leg I had up until I was 20, I had the same sort of, I literally had a wooden leg with sort of metal hinges on the side. And if you can imagine the way like a door would swing, the bottom sort of swung freely. It wasn't on any hydraulic system. So the motion was all up to me to run the leg, in essence. And it was attached by a waist strap. So you would slip it on over the stump and then tie the strap around and like buckle it in the front. And so it was the sort of the oldest model of a wooden leg. It's very sort of rudimentary model, but it worked for me. And then I met someone who had an hydraulic prosthesis, and that just totally changed my world. I found a new prosthetist, I got a new leg, and now I have like a four-bar hydraulic knee that is sort of the hard, like the harder you, if you think of a door, the harder you push against a hydraulic door, the more it resists. It's that kind of a system. So like the knee can lock out. I can control my motion more, that kind of thing. And it's also held on by a suction system. So there's no longer a waist strap, which was probably the most uncomfortable thing about wearing the first wooden leg.
So you can get around pretty well now?
Yeah. I mean, I can do what I want to do. I can, you know, be active and do all kinds of different sports. And, you know, if I want to do it, I can usually find a way to do it.
You know, you mentioned that when you were young, the only other people you knew in your town who had limbs that were amputated were veterans.
Right. Well, they weren't even in my town, actually. They were in Denver. So
there was no one in my town, like a special clinic that you went to. Uh-huh.
Yeah, there was no prosthetic clinic in Laramie. So.
Well, and you say you almost envy them because they all had like a really dramatic story about how they lost the limb. And you didn't. I mean, you lost your foot before you were old enough to really comprehend what was going on. And there wasn't this kind of dramatic war story or anything like that to tell. And I feel like in a way you've substituted your book for that. You know, now you have a whole memoir focusing on it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the thing about the Vietnam vets that was so great is that they gave me my first community of people with disabilities, and they were so non-judgmental. They were so fun to be around. And I don't think, honestly, they quite knew what to do with me because I was so up in their face all the time and, you know, forcing them to play games with me and hopping around. And, you know, and I think they found it a relief to sort of to be with someone who was more playful about having a disability, where for them it was attached to these sort of incredibly traumatic memories. But of course, it's such a six-year-old's logic to be like, ooh, I wish I had a dramatic story, you know, not having any idea what the implications of that might be. But I really do. I have such a I had such love and respect for those guys. They were so brave in a different way than I had ever experienced before.
Have you gone through a lot of your life feeling that you were at war with your body because your bones were growing unevenly and that required the amputation and that required the leg prosthetic? And I mean, it's like you literally were at war at war with your body. Like doctors had to like cut off parts of your body over a series of operations. And once you start feeling that way, how do you stop? How do you make peace with your body?
Well, I don't know if I know a clear answer to that. I think the easy answer is to say that you do it every day. You have to say, you know, you have to sort of reclaim that body every day and sort of be forgiving of it. And I don't think I felt as a child at war with my body again because I was a child and I sort of just dealt with what was given to me. It was only later in my life that I felt the effects of that and began to feel like, you know, why me, why this, that sort of, you know, those feelings of pity, which I certainly don't have anymore. But I do think that it's, there's no easy answer to that question about making peace. And people often ask me, what was the moment when you finally accepted your body? And my answer to that is, you know, I have to do it all the time. Well, there was no switch that was flipped. And also being conscious of the fact that my whole, you know, worries and self-consciousness about my body is a reflection of my privilege as well. I mean, many people in other places aren't able to, you know, sit around thinking about how they feel about their bodies. And I'm also conscious of that, especially people with disabilities around the world. So I guess I would say it's a daily process.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Emily Rapp's new memoir is called Poster Child. A Golden Globe last night is just one sign of Alec Baldwin's current popularity. Coming up, our critic at large, John Powers, has some thoughts on why Baldwin is connecting with audiences now. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Alec Baldwin won a Golden Globe last night for his role as a TV executive in the NBC comedy 30 Rock. Our critic at large, John Powers, thinks Baldwin deserves the recognition he's getting now and has some ideas about why Baldwin has become so popular.
Not so long ago, I wasn't alone in thinking that Alec Baldwin had thrown away his career. Although extremely talented and almost comically handsome, he'd quit his franchise role as Tom Clancy's hero, Jack Ryan, which he thought was beneath him, only to star in a series of flops like The Getaway and Heaven's Prisoners. Along the way, he'd come to be seen as a prima donna, complete with a messy marriage to Kim Basinger, an arrest for punching out paparazzi, and political pronouncements that made him sound desperate for attention. His real stardom was found in the tabloids. But America loves a happy second act. And at 48, Baldwin is now one of our most beloved performers. When he appears on Saturday Night Live, the crowd whoops with unbridled delight. And I whoop too. Nothing makes me happier than seeing Baldwin's name in the opening credits of a movie like The Departed or The Good Shepherd. He's gone from being a bum to a hero celebrated in every newspaper and magazine. And the reason for this change tells us something about pop culture. In Baldwin's case, he became more popular because he became more human. He put on weight, set aside the idea of being a leading man, and most important, he dropped every shred of actorly self-seriousness. Unafraid to look silly, he began having fun. And the audience feels that, even when he's in a serious role. Although Baldwin often plays overbearing authority figures, he does it with such obvious relish that we share his delight. He thoroughly deserved to win the Golden Globe for his work as TV executive Jack Donaghy on 30 Rock. Without him and his crack timing, the show's a dead duck. Here, Jack goes after the show's lead character, she's played by Tina Fey, on the question of having children.
Lemon, we have a problem.
I have this whole Tracy Josh thing under control.
What are you talking about?
Nothing. What are you talking about?
You. You yelling at the crew. You trawling for seed.
Oh, it's a big misunderstanding. Jenna thinks that I want to have a baby.
I should have known this was going to be a problem when I decided to mentor a woman.
No, in fact, what I said was that my body is trying to make me think I want to have a baby, but my body is not the boss of me. My brain is.
All right. If you insist upon going all Murphy Brown on me, let me give you a tip. Don't smother your child with affection to compensate for not having a man in your life. Don't say you're the only man I'll ever love. Even babies know that's creepy.
Of course.
Don't put little notes in their lunch bag that say, Mommy's watching you. People find those things.
I bet you behaved yourself, though.
If your child is a terrific hockey player and a gifted flautist, don't make them play the national anthem on the flute in front of their teammates.
Your mother did that?
Now she wants to move in with me. I can't have that, Lemon.
Then be an adult and call her and say you love her very much, but that living together is not going to work for you.
You don't know my mother. This is a woman that actually had a heart attack to prevent me from going on my honeymoon.
Maybe her heart broke because she spent 20 years raising you and you're a total ingrate.
That's exactly what she said. Is this what you want, Lemon, to breathe life into another human being, just to spend the rest of your days slowly sucking it out of them?
No. That's why my brain is the boss.
Speak of the devil.
Take a breath. Be nice.
Listening to this, you can tell Baldwin's having a blast. Now, it's hardly news that audiences like to watch actors who are having a good time. Back in its golden age, Hollywood knew this by heart. That's why the very quintessence of the movie star was Cary Grant, who exuded an incomparable buoyancy both on screen and off. Coming to fame during the Great Depression and World War II, he embodied the supremely bearable lightness of being. All that changed over the next decades, and the prestige of Grant's style began to wane. In the wake of The Method and post-war prosperity, acting became a more self-consciously serious business, with too many performers aping Marlon Brando's sense of inner turmoil while overlooking his playfulness. It became an Oscar cliché that top prizes would go to those who immolated themselves in their characters, gaining dozens of pounds like Robert De Niro in Raging Bull, making themselves ugly like Charlize Theron in Monster, or suffering grandiloquently in a whole slew of impeccable accents, like Meryl Streep throughout the 1980s. But while we may admire such committed performances, we seldom love them, as earlier audiences loved the work of Grant or Carol Lombard or Jimmy Stewart. It's no accident that both Streep and Johnny Depp, two voluminously gifted actors, have become more popular than ever now that they're so transparently having a good time in movies like The Devil Wears Prada or Pirates of the Caribbean. Looser and more relaxed than ever, Streep's Miranda Priestly is every bit as compelling a character as, say, the heroine of Sophie's Choice, who's so hermetically sealed in Streep's performance that we can't get inside her. And the same logic holds true off the screen as well. The reason George Clooney is today's best movie star, our closest thing to Cary Grant, is that he lets us in on his pleasure. He lets us know it's just great being a handsome movie star who gets to act in movies of his own choosing, own a house on Lake Como, play practical jokes on his friends, and find the UN eager to hear his political opinions. He's almost the opposite of Sean Penn, who, for all his gifts, is perpetually imprisoned in miserabilism. Penn seems to find acting a form of agony, and fame even worse. Audiences are impatient with such an attitude, especially in a time of war and economic insecurity. We don't mind if our entertainers have political opinions, but we do want them to enjoy being entertainers. That's why we're so thrilled when someone like Alec Baldwin decides to cut loose and have some fun. By abandoning all pretense to being an important actor, he's not only made us love him, he's doing the work for which he'll be remembered.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Menhivar, and Joan Tui Westman. Ian Chillog directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Ovid's The Metamorphoses, in stores and online at bn.com. From Rosalind Croman Swig, thanking the donors to the NPR Foundation and councils for their support of NPR programming. And from the Broad Foundations, encouraging entrepreneurship for the public good in education, science, and the arts at broadfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The series premiere of the Canadian sitcom Little Mosque on the Prairie, about a group of Muslims living in a Saskatchewan prairie town, got the biggest audience the CBC network has had in 10 years. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the show's creator, Zakhar Nawaz. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.